Welcome to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. Conversations focused on how some of the world's top energy leaders are innovating to deliver clean, affordable, and reliable energy for the future. Your hosts are energy and climate expert, Dr. Andrew Parker, and midstream industry veteran, Adam Murray. Now, here are Andrew and Adam.
Hey everyone, welcome back to our latest episode of the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast. As always, I'm joined with Andrew Parker. How's it going today, Andrew?
It's going great. I'm pumped for this conversation.
Love it. And then also joined today by Johanna Ostrom. How are you doing today?
I'm awesome. I'm excited to be here.
All right. So we love to start off the conversation with an icebreaker. And before we hit record, you're telling us your basketball family. You got three girls. You guys play basketball. You're watching a lot of WNBA right now. And so let's clear the air. Do you prefer Caitlin Clark at Iowa, or do you think you're going to enjoy watching her more with the Indiana Fever?
Yeah, I'm glad you guys threw me this softball because I've just recently become a WNBA fan. I played sports growing up, but then my daughters have really gotten into basketball. So
love it.
We watched a lot of the NCAA tournament this year, probably the first time I've really gotten into the March Madness stuff. But so our company is based in Denver, Colorado. I live close to Boulder. So we went to a lot of CU Buff games. And they were ranked, the women are ranked top 10 most of the year. So we got to see them play like Juju Watkins at USC and some of the UCLA games and stuff. But all that to say, I also am a Caitlin Clark fan. And time will tell whether she does well at the WNBA level, but I think she's been doing really well. So I'm going to cheer on in her new endeavor in the WNBA at the Fever.
I think I watched more of the women's tournament this year, to be completely honest, than I watched of the men's tournament. Like, she's absolutely incredible hitting those long three pointers. Like, it's amazing.
Yeah, to timestamp it, right? It's the start of the WNBA season right now. They've played a couple games. Nuggets are down 0-2. We'll see if they win tonight. So
good luck to them.
Yeah.
They got a tough opponent.
That's right.
Go ahead.
So,
Johanna, let's dive into some of the substance here. You are the COO for a company called Gradient Geothermal. And tell us a little bit about what Gradient Geothermal is and what you guys have set out to do.
Yeah, so Gradient Geothermal has been around since October of 2023. Prior to that, the team at Transitional Energy, which started in 2020, really built this company with the idea of how do you capture thermal energy from oil and gas wells that's produced right along with the hydrocarbons, capture that, generate geothermal electricity to use on site or to net meter and sell to the grid. So this is the idea of like capturing waste streams from oil and gas and figuring out how to turn a profit and do some good with it. And so that Transitional Energy existed from 2020 up till 2023 and then merged with Gradient. I think technically it's still a DBA, still exists, but we're kind of all operating under the Gradient Geothermal hat. But it's been fun. I started before the LLC was formed. Can't call myself a founder, but I was right in the door after the idea came around. And my background's in oil and gas. I was an engineer in that space for a little under two decades. But I'm a subsurface nerd. I have a geological engineering degree by training. And so really any sort of subsurface energy I think is awesome, and we should figure out how to utilize it. So, and you know, repurposing things or capturing waste sources that weren't thought of as a resource before is fun. So it's been an entertaining trip in the startup geothermal space.
So if you had to explain what geothermal energy is to like your grandmother, how would you explain it?
Yeah, so you can break down the word. Geo is earth and thermal is energy. So it's the heat of the earth that's never ending resource. And why that heat is there's two reasons. One is it's leftover heat from the formation of the planet. And then secondarily, it's radioactive decay of thorium and strontium in the core of the Earth, of the mantle. So it's really, really hot. The deeper you go, the hotter it gets. It's molten at the core of the Earth. So this resource has been around since the beginning of the planet, and humans have been using it for as long as we have recorded history, right? Thermal hot springs for soaking. They use it to clean and process their food, clothing. Like, this idea of using the heat has been around for a long time, but we haven't been great at capturing that heat to use it for energy and electricity to its full extent. And what's exciting about this space now is there's a lot more innovation and dollars going into funding that innovation to figure out how to develop geothermal energy outside of like the Pacific Ring of Fire or right next to a volcano, right? That's obvious there's heat there. Now it's figuring out how to develop it in new places.
So a lot of things we talk about with, you know, carbon energy or fossil fuels, right, is they're reliable, they're efficient, you know, all the things that you probably heard in the past. But you just mentioned, you know, developing this energy out of fossil fuel sources and other places. But how does it compare, you know, efficiency wise to fossil fuels, to renewable energy type resources?
Yeah, efficiency is important. And I think that's been one of the things that's hard to move away from fossil fuels, because they're highly efficient for how much energy they have. So, but when you think about moving to a decarbonized energy future, how are we going to replace coal plants? How are we going to replace natural gas plants? Geothermal is really the only renewable energy baseload resource that can do that. I mean, nuclear should be part of the conversation. And I think hopefully will be part of the conversation, but it just takes so long to go through the permitting process. And it's not truly emissions free in the fact that you do have a waste after you're done. Geothermal is just capturing that thermal energy. And there's lots of different ways to do that, whether that's with steam or hot water that you can cycle and heat up again. There's a lot of cool technology happening in this space. But in terms of efficiency, it's an always on resource. You talk about capacity factor. So what's the uptime essentially of different types of renewable energy? So geothermal is at like 90 to 95%. You talk about solar, that's more about 20 to 30%. And wind varies, but it's right about there too. So you've got to marry wind and solar with battery, because that's your storage mechanism to handle kind of the duck curve issue that you have, where you make a lot of energy in the middle of the day, but everybody goes home and turns on their air conditioning units. You don't have the power of the resource unless you've got a way to store that, which is battery storage, which has its own environmental impacts for that. But that's what I'm excited about geothermal is. Really, it's the next technology that can help provide reliability to the grid to handle the issue.
So you mentioned the use of water. Is it a pretty water-intensive process in your guys' case, or are there other technologies that are water intensive as well?
Yeah, what's so interesting is you think about the heat of the Earth, water is just the conduit through which we capture the thermal energy. You could really use any other resource, but you've just got to bring that heat up to the surface. So our system actually captures heat from oil, gas, or water. So we can handle all three phases through our system. And traditional geothermal is, you know, steam type applications where you're drilling in the geysers in California, and how they even found it, there was a steam vent there. So it's very old school, like, oh, there's steam here. Kind of like when they saw oil in the creek, they said, oh, we should probably drill an oil well there. That's what happened with the geysers in California. So they just capture the steam and generate electricity, but then that water is reinjected to be heated up again. So there's very little actual loss of water other than what you get from some of the steam, you know, evaporating into the atmosphere. But in some of the newer technologies, it's all closed loop. And I say closed loop in that the water brings the thermal energy up to the surface. You use another type of fluid to turn into a vapor, like a refrigerant that has a lower boiling point than water. That spins a turbine, and that's what generates electricity. But that water then goes right back into the ground to be heated up again. So in terms of impact to subsurface waters, there's no, you know, no loss or no gain to that system.
So you said something, and I wanted to clarify, and this is going to show how little I know about geothermal energy. So I'm learning stuff as you're talking, but you know, you talked about wind and solar has to be married to battery power, right? And then I think you made a comment about geothermal can be a base load. And for me, I don't think I've ever thought of geothermal as a potential base load energy. And so like maybe expand on that idea that geothermal could be, you know, a base load energy. And like, I guess in my head, I have like for geothermal, just like an individual house with like a heat pump or something like that, right? But can it, is it scalable to something bigger than that?
Yeah, good point. Geothermal is kind of a whole ecosystem of technologies that you can use both in your home for ground source heat pumps for heating and cooling of your home. That is definitely a viable old technology that is still being implemented today to decarbonize the built environment. So that is part of geothermal. There's also a part where you use thermal energy to dry crops, to heat greenhouses, to build swimming pools like we know and love, right? But then there's also a geothermal piece where you're taking that heat and you're using it to generate electricity, to spin a turbine, essentially, as you would in like a dam or something, right? Just that spinning of that turbine generates electricity. So there is a whole ecosystem of geothermal energy. When you think about using it for homes, yeah, there's an ability to cool or heat, because if you drill down, you know, 5 or 10 feet, it's a steady 55 degrees Fahrenheit all the time. So you can use that to cool in the summertime, or you can use that to heat in the wintertime. Highly efficient, except on those very, very hot days or those very, very cold days. And then it needs some electrical help to get it to work. Where I was talking about baseload, I was really referring to power generation, in the fact that, again, the earth is always on. You're always going to produce hot water to surface if you got everything, your system set up correctly. And that is a resource that's always on. And that's what I was referring to, kind of replacing those natural gas and coal-fired power plants, because you can turn pumps up and turn pumps down. If you've got the right type of reservoir, it can ramp up or ramp down depending on what you need.
Okay, so maybe along those lines, then talk a little bit more about just the geology and geographic, you know, viability of geothermal, right? Like, you know, how can you do geothermal anywhere?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Or are there locations like, oh, you know, around Yellowstone, there's, you know, a lot more geothermal heat close to the surface, right? So like, how does it vary geographically in terms of viability?
So heat, if you drill deeper into the earth, you're going to get a hotter resource, but you need, just like you would in oil and gas, you need a reservoir that can deliver fluid to you that you can then pump that heat up to the surface. So you want permeability, you want porosity, you want a lot of fluid deliverability. So if you're looking at where you can, in sedimentary basins, where the best place to drills are, it's going to be locations that have a high heat flow and have fractures that can produce a lot of fluid to your wellbore. And that's what you're seeing with companies like Fervo and Ormat and CERC. They're drilling those type of locations. But there's also a technology where it's entirely closed loop. So you don't need to find a reservoir. You're drilling two wells that, and then turning horizontally and connecting them. There's all sorts of geometry that you can use to drill these types of wells. Ever is a company that's been doing this for a while and has an operating test site up in Canada. But that's where you don't need a specific reservoir. You just need to drill some super deep wells and connect them. And how deep you drill them is dependent on the temperature gradient of the particular region. So yeah, it would be better closer to, say, Yellowstone. Of course, we can't ever drill too close to that, but like some sort of known magma source that's pretty close to the surface, Iceland or something like that. But there are many maps that have been made of the US and now of the world that show where there's high temperature gradients. So they kind of show up like hot red zones, and you know, okay, there's a resource here. Either we drill it, try to find high permeability fractures, or you can try this kind of closed loop technology to access those resources.
So outside of location, which Andrew, I was going to ask the same thing, like, why don't we put these, you know, right in the middle of New York City or whatever, but you know, what are some of the other main challenges? I know we're dealing with an extremely complex process here, so I don't want to oversimplify it, but you know, to date, what are kind of the biggest challenges of getting this stuff off the ground and making it a viable, you know, base load provider?
Yeah, I would say economics has been the biggest hurdle to date. I heard someone say this at a conference and it really stuck with me. So a barrel of oil is $80, say. A barrel of hot water is $8. So, or sometimes 8 cents, depending on what market you're selling into. So the price of power is just a lot less than you would find for, granted it's consistent, so you just pay a 20-year PPA, so that's nice, but it's not super high returns like you might have in some oil and gas plays. So you need to be close to a market where you can get really good power pricing, and that's generally California. And you need a resource. So those are the two things you really need to make economics work. And so that's why a lot of drilling has happened in Nevada, where they sell into California. Now they're developing in Utah again, where they're transmitting it to California. It'd be great if we could drill and find good resources on the East Coast, because there's massive demand there, but it's not very hot if you look at a map, right? And the geology hasn't been drilled quite as extensively as the West has. So there's more drilling risk. But technology is advancing where costs are coming down. They are now starting to drill horizontal wells. That was not a thing in geothermal until really a couple years ago. Yep. And Forge was a DOE-funded project that really proved like, hey, you can do this. It's not that this concept wasn't there. It was, they didn't have tools. Like high temperature tools just fail at 350, 400 degrees Fahrenheit. So even if folks wanted to, the oil and gas technology you'd want to use to drill those wells just plain didn't work at those temperatures. So this Forge project has really tested oil field technology and gotten some new technology working that can handle that high temperature.
When I think about economic viability of something, right, I always wonder if there are other uses. Are there any other use cases outside of just strictly making power that you guys are looking into or are doing?
Absolutely. So at Gradient, we take the approach, let's use existing wells that have already accessed this temperature and are actually producing fluid to surface right now that comes along with the hydrocarbons but are hot enough to generate power. So we're excited about that, but where there's opportunities to take that hot water after we've generated power and provide some community benefit to school nearby, homes nearby, buildings, because a lot of oil and gas development, it is in and around communities. And can you take that heat that is still a resource that can be used for greenhouses or things like that? Vermilion Energy, they're a company based out of Canada. They have a development in France where they've signed two long-term contracts with different towns in France where they provide heating for housing development, and then another case where they're providing heat for a greenhouse that grows tomatoes. So there has been cases of this happening where you can generate power and then also provide beneficial use for communities nearby. So there's this stackable value stream for use.
Okay, you guys are still in Colorado. I haven't been in Colorado in a while other than work trips, but it's not geothermal, I don't think. But doesn't the Coors Brewery or something heat the School of Mines, like the university? I'm pretty sure they have underground steam pipes that actually like provide heat to the university. Anyways.
Yeah, that's more than I know. That would be cool. That is cool.
If someone from Coors is listening, please let us know. DM Adam. I'm just so lost in thought right now listening to you, because like I said, I truly knew very little about geothermal. What are I don't mean to put you on the spot. I didn't ask you this in the email prep, but like, what percent of electricity in the United States is being generated by geothermal right now?
A tiny, tiny percentage. So yeah. Mostly in California, I think it's anywhere from 5 to 7% of the power in California is from geothermal. Okay. What's really cool is you'll see, you know, issues where solar's not working because of fires and there's a bunch of ash on top of the solar panels, or they have wildfires where they have to shut stuff in, geothermal is just chugging along 5 to 7% all the time. Isn't affected by major storms, anything like that. So it's a good case study to show kind of how consistent this power source is. But it's United States is the largest producer of geothermal energy in the world, but it's a small percentage of our power use, and it hasn't really changed that much. I will say a lot more power purchase agreements have been signed in the past 5 years or so than have been signed previously. And it's by, you know, some startups that are making some headway on building out more geothermal power production.
And hopefully the listeners have picked up on the underlying narrative here, that is the synergistic nature of geothermal to the oil and gas industry, right? Like, there's a lot of like complementary use cases that you've already talked about, right? With using wells that have already been drilled to get to the temperatures that you guys need. And I'm just curious, you know, the well, is this something that you could adapt to like a zombie well that you know, is kind of out there and it's drilled and not necessarily producing? Or do you need fresh wells? Like, what is the ideal scenario you're looking for in that relationship with oil and gas?
Yeah, zombie wells kind of give me a little shiver when you say it like that. So the idea of taking, idle wells or wells that are no longer economic to produce from the oil and gas standpoint, those can be good candidates for what we're doing at Gradient Geothermal. Sometimes, though, those are no longer producing because there's issues. There's holes in casing. There's leaky flow lines. It's an environmental risk that we don't really want to step in and perpetuate, right? So you have to be very careful when you look at those type of wells. The easiest and least risk is to work with wells that are already producing and that are new, right? And we already know what the production looks like. We are confident in the bottom hole temperatures and what it's producing. But there are opportunities to use other wells. You just need to do a lot of due diligence, right? You need to use all the tools available in the tool belt from an oil and gas standpoint to understand, can the casing hold pressure? You know, where's the cement set at? Just to make sure those wells are safe to be used.
If someone listens to this or wants to learn more, are there any good resources to, you know, research geothermal energy or videos that you've seen or books that you've read? Any suggestions on where to go to learn more?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff coming out right now. And I was just looking for some papers earlier today. I'm going to give a talk on geothermal policy on the 20th in Houston, Geothermal Technology Summit. But there are there's some nonprofits doing some great work in this space. Clean Air Task Force is a large proponent of super hot rock geothermal. So that's where you drill really deep and really hot, but the resource is great, right? The deeper you get, the better the resource. Geothermal Rising is the industry trade group, and they have a lot of good resources on their website. And there are some other folks that are doing some good research. The national labs are always great. We work with the National Renewable Energy Lab quite a bit. We were a recipient of a Department of Energy grant in 2020, and they're one of our project partners, and they consistently put out really good reports about all sorts of things, economics, technical feasibility, policy recommendations. So they're a great resource to look at.
Love it. Love it. Andrew, what else you got?
So 5 years, 10 years out, what does the future look like for geothermal, and what is the future look like for Gradient Geothermal?
Great question. I would love to see that, you know, 5 to 7% number in California and like less than 1% in the US kind of budge upwards, right? It's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of drilling and a lot of capital to get geothermal really making a large impact on the national scale, but we're headed in the right direction. And I think there's some companies doing some very exciting things, including Gradient Geothermal. And in 5 years, I plan to have a lot of units capturing waste heat from oil and gas wells in several different basins and outside the U.S. as well. So we want to use geothermal energy to help, you know, decarbonize and reduce emissions, both on the electrical grid and at oil and gas sites, right? If they can use our basically hot water generators instead of natural gas or diesel generators, that's a pretty instantaneous emissions reduction tool. And it can be a scope two emissions, right? If you're, if you, instead of connecting to the grid and using coal-based power, you can generate emissions free electricity on site. Like, that helps reduce emissions. It's not, you know, all the easy emission reduction things have been done, right? For the most part, either willingly or regulatorily have happened. And now it's, how do we think about running an oil and gas site as cleanly and efficiently as possible? And that's, why not use all the resources that are coming out of the ground to do that?
You know, you bring up a good point on policy. You know, with the previous and the current administration sort of being at odds, have you seen any, you know, changes in that, or has it just kind of been pretty steady as far as, you know, policy directed towards you guys? Is it pretty permit friendly? Is it, you know, easy or difficult to kind of get site selected and move forward?
Geothermal has historically kind of been ignored in terms of, we'll talk tax credits and things, until the Inflation Reduction Act. Geothermal didn't get many tax credits, was not treated the same as wind and solar, and had a constant like sunset clause. So every year there was this hope that they would continue to get like a 10% tax credit. But with the Inflation Reduction Act, a lot of that changed, which is great. The current Department of Energy head, Secretary Granholm, is a big supporter of geothermal. I think it's not only just a, you know, why aren't we using this resource from a technical aspect, but it's also a job story for oil and gas workers, right? If in the current administration, there is, you know, they'd like to see oil and gas kind of stay where it's at and potentially, you know, not do a lot more drilling. And geothermal is a natural transition for folks that can't need to take these skills that they've built, all this amazing technical expertise, and it's very transferable to geothermal. I myself am a story of that. Most of the folks in my company have come from oil and gas. So there's a jobs transition story there. But luckily, strangely enough, geothermal has been positively received by both kind of the left and the right, the red and the blue. It's a clear story that it's a resource that we should be developing, and it's a great jobs creator for folks.
I think that's an awesome point that, shame on us for not getting too earlier in this discussion, is the job overlap with oil and gas, right? I mean, like, I've spent a lot of time in Wyoming. It's been a few years in North Dakota, and, you know, a place like Williston, North Dakota, Gillette, Wyoming, you don't have coal or you have oil and gas, like, what do you have? And I think, you know, some employees, some of the field workers in those areas see the transition as a threat, and yet here is geothermal, and you can almost translate those skills across the board. So I think that's such a wonderful point that you make. And the other point that I was going to make too, that I was just sitting here thinking about, was, again, going back to your comment about pairing solar and wind with battery storage. And one thing that doesn't get enough airtime, I think, is the supply chain, the underdeveloped supply chain, especially around the critical minerals that you need for batteries and scaling batteries and stuff like that. Correct me if I'm wrong, that's not necessarily a limitation for geothermal.
Yeah, there's no need for any rare earth minerals in the geothermal process. So in terms of impact, I mean, we use steel, same you would use to build most of the things we have in our modern lives. But no, there's no big resource demand for geothermal in terms of mining, right? So yeah, if you want to think about full chain development, full chain impacts, environmental impacts of different resources, geothermal has very, very small impact. And it's also like a surface impact is very small as well. Our 75 kilowatt unit that we have actually in North Dakota right now, Andrew, that's about to turn onto a pad at the end of next week, 75 kilowatt unit, it's maybe 8 feet by 50 feet long. It's this long, skinny system. Our Gen 2 design is going to be about half that size. So if you were to do that in solar panels, it's like a 1 acre system or something. It's very, very different land impacts, which is what oil and gas has great about it too, right? Very, a lot of energy comes out of a very small space.
Yeah.
Geothermal similar.
Well, we only got a few minutes left, and Andrew kind of stole our last question that we typically ask.
I realized it. I'm sorry. I can ask closing one. It won't be the 3 to 5 year question, but, you know, Johanna, you and I are both board members at the Energy Leadership Institute, and That's the group that puts on the NGEN program. And Jess Laramie, also, who was on our last episode, also part of that group. But maybe in your parting words, share just a little bit about, you know, your thoughts on that program and why you're part of it.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. I knew about the Energy Leadership Institute. I've been in Denver most of my career, and that early program was really focused on oil and gas development. And so I knew a lot of folks that went through that program and spoke very highly of it. And so when I made that transition to geothermal and heard that this program was becoming more of a, hey, we've got an energy problem to solve and we all need to figure out how to solve it. It's not just oil and gas. It's all of us. It's all energy sources need to figure out how to do this. I was excited about the shift in that. And Ann Carter reached out to me and asked if I wanted to be a part of it. And of course, yeah, I think teaching energy leaders about how to be better leaders and how to understand how the whole ecosystem impacts each other is very important. We all like to be in our own silos, whether we do it on purpose or not. And I like breaking down silos and having, you know, cross-cultural conversations. And I've loved that this energy leadership program really fosters that. And so I've been proud to be a part of it. And Andrew, it was really nice to meet you through the last 2023 cohort. And I've been very glad to see that you joined and helped us with the next and the future cohorts of NGEN.
No, it's been so much fun. And yeah, just the collaborative nature, right? Bringing people from all energy backgrounds together to figure out how we're going to work on this together rather than in our respective silos has been probably one of the coolest, it's one of the coolest aspects of it. So, you know, folks who are listening and whether I think the application is going to open here in the next few months, keep an eye on the website. And, you know, certainly if you want to help sponsor that program, reach out to one of us, but it's an awesome program. So Adam, we're bringing all the Eli people on this season, I guess is how it's going to be.
That's all right. A bunch of highly educated people that know what they're talking about on an energy podcast. I don't know how we could go wrong. So seems fair.
That's right. Yeah.
I want to thank you so much for coming on. We're about out of time here, but I certainly would love to extend the invitation for you to come back on, you know, in the next year or so. One, to hear about how kind of the company's doing. Maybe you can budge that 7% or whatever it was, the 1% off of dead center there, and see if we can get some growth in energy and do all the things. But it's really interesting learning about an oil and gas adjacent technology that I think, you know, more and more people should start paying attention to. You're kind of over there waving the flag, and, you know, certainly there's cause to take a look at it. So appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm also very excited that more geothermal curriculums being added to schools like Colorado School of Mines and Montana Tech, my alumni and my husband's alumni, I guess, alumnus. But yeah, I'm excited about how we get students and academics excited about this new industry and new opportunity for some really smart people to make a big impact.
Love it. Well, thanks again. And to everyone listening, make sure to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. And also, you know, I'm open for hat sponsorships. I keep wearing different hats on all these, all these podcasts. If you guys watch our YouTube videos, certainly would be open to wearing different hats. So, Andrew, any closing thoughts?
No, I've learned more in the last 30 minutes than I have up to this point. So actually, I'm pretty excited about geothermal, and hopefully the listeners are too. So thanks for taking the time to join us.
Appreciate it, guys. It was really fun.
Catch you next time, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast with Adam Murray and Dr. Andrew Parker. If you like what you have heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to Let's Clear the Air Energy Podcast @gmail.com.